Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. So, what happens when two storytellers get together? You get a really long episode. Robert Norris, Bob, has had a pretty unusual life. Growing into young adulthood, just as American involvement in the Vietnam War was accelerating, realizing his conscientious objectivism couldn't mesh with his military obligations, lots of travel, drugs, and bouncing about, all culminating in finding a calling in a foreign country. The one constant pillar throughout it all was his mom, a strong, adventurous, independent woman before most women were brave enough to leave their mark in a male-dominated world. Their stories come together in Bob's book, The Good Lord Willing and the Creek Don't Rise, Pentimento Memories of Mom and Me. I read the book before we chatted and I couldn't put it down, so I was really looking forward to hearing more in person. Listen now. Many of you know I find my guests through my Podmatch platform. Once in a while, though, a guest will find me and ask to be on podcast. When today's guest messaged me, it wasn't a quick, how do you do, please have me on podcast. It's a lengthy email. He told me what he liked about several of our episodes he'd listened to. He gave me some personal background. And then he talked about his mom and the book he'd written about her. As I read both Bob's details and his mom's, I saw parallels between them and me and my mom. Growing up in the Pacific Northwest, logging camps, Air Force stations, stalwart mothers whose spirits seemed indomitable. I can't say that word. I've been practicing and I still can't do it. And who wouldn't hesitate to call a spade a damn shovel if the need arose. I actually have something else in common with Robert, Bob. But we'll get to that later, and hopefully you'll have a laugh. Right now, let me introduce him. Robert Norris, welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
First of all, I do need to apologize to you, Bob. A few days ago when I searched my email so I could find your email address to send you the link for our meet today, I found that you emailed me last August. I started checking, thinking, why did I not see this? It had come in on Saturday, and I guess by the time I got to my email on the weekend, it had dropped so far down that I didn't see it. So I really am sorry about that. Although judging from your last email, you've listened to more of our episodes, so maybe that's okay.
Yeah, not to worry, not to worry. Actually, I'd forgotten about that too.
Okay. Well, when I saw it, because it's in the bold print, I'm going like, oh my God, what have I done? So anyways, we're going to talk about your book. It's such a great recount of your grandparents' and great-grandparents' time, recounted mostly by your mom, as well as her and your own stories. I love stories and the power of story. Is that oral tradition being lost in these times of digital communication?
Oh, geez, I surely hope not, because, you know, as a boy growing up in the country, you know, way out in the redwoods of Northern California, and this was basically before many families had TV. So a lot of times our entertainment was just sitting around in the living room and my mother and my grandmother telling stories, wonderful stories. And of course, they had a bit of the Irish imagination and the gift of the gab. And so you could hear the same story maybe 10 different times, and each time it would be embellished in a slightly different way, but we always had a good laugh. You know, they were wonderful at timing and setting up a situation, delivering a punchline on time, and depending on who the audience was and you know, how they were reacting to the story, they could even go further into details. And it was just a wonderful tradition, and hopefully, you know, I've inherited some of that DNA because the Irish part of me still likes to talk a lot and tell stories. But yeah, these days, it's hard to say. I mean, with social media and everybody's attention span has been reduced so drastically that to be able to spend hours and hours in front of a fire in the wintertime, you know, sipping on hot chocolate or something and listening to stories, that was a wonderful way to pass the time.
I remember those stories, and you sound a lot like my auntie. My mom had an English background, And I actually have a page or a section of my website called Stories My Mother Told Me. Now, it's still got a long way to go. But I realized that in my family, I'm the only person who knew many of the people of my mom's and grandmother's generation and who spent time with them and then could join the dots. And those stories will be gone forever when my pixie dust runs out.
Well, that was one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book. About 3 years ago, my mother passed, and she was almost 95 when she passed. And I realized that, oh my God, all those great stories that she told and that her mother told, especially about, you know, crossing the United States from North Dakota to Oregon and Washington during the Depression, not really unlike the Jode family in Steinbeck's classic, The Grapes of Wrath. It was a unique time in history, and it's often, I think, lost in terms of the way it's presented in film a lot of times. But, you know, to hear the stories from people who really experienced those times and what they learned from those times is probably an invaluable education, I think. And I just felt that, geez, I have to preserve mom's story somehow and grandma's stories. And so that was kind of the motivation for writing the book. But our lives were so intertwined that it just seemed to work best if I included my story too. And so what started out as probably two separate book ideas kind of merged into one long tome. it was, you know, from what the response I've had from, you know, the readers that have actually, you know, made it through to the end has been quite good. And they were very impressed by my mom's character, my grandma's character, and the way they dealt with adversity. And their main tool for doing that was basically humor. You know, they were able to see the humorous side of even the worst of situations. And I think that helped them to survive a lot. And humor is something that we could sure use a lot of today, that's for sure. Especially amongst politicians.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's funny, I was telling somebody a story just the other day of this incident with my 10-year-old son, who, it was my father's funeral, for goodness sakes, and I'm giving him the look, you know, because he's done something that I think is highly inappropriate in front of my grieving mother. And then I look over at my mother, and you're talking about humor. She's sitting there, she's staring at the TV, and she's just, her shoulders are shaking, and she's trying not to laugh out loud because she knows I'm trying to discipline. But yeah, it was just almost like the comic relief that everybody needed. But anyways, the story is about Kay, and as I said, she sounds just like tenacious. Nothing was going to get her, well, I won't say get her down, but nothing was going to break that spirit, that drive, that just, I don't know, it's a combination of worldliness, but also family. Tell us some things about Kay, pieces of Kay, that made her stand out as a woman, especially in her time.
Oh, geez. I have so many.
And I've
really
got a list here if you need any
her.
Prompting.
Yeah. If I forget anything, please do.
That's right. Yeah. I'm going to make sure you cover this all. Yeah.
I suppose just her determination more than anything. And I think that and her independence, you know, she grew up in a very poor family. And of course, during the Depression in the 1930s. And so for her, family was everything, and she was one of the best contributors to the survival of the family. She was a hard worker in her teens in a small town of Washington on the Columbia River called White Salmon. At any one time, she would be working picking fruit during the harvest season. She would be working in a hardware store, keeping the books for the local hardware store. She worked as an usher at the movie theater. And, you know, every little penny that she was able to save went towards the family. They shared everything. If the family was able to get maybe 20 different oranges as a Christmas present, her father would sit down and count out the oranges and count how many relatives he had to give it to. And it usually would end up where my mother and her brother would have to share one of the oranges. And so she had a real sense of, you know, the value of the dollar and how important or how hard it was to even get a dollar in your pocket. But when she was a teenager, of course, this was during World War II. So all the young men were basically, you know, sent abroad. And one summer, I think when she was either a sophomore or junior in high school, they needed a fire lookout on the top of this hill in the middle of the forest to check for smoke or fires. And so she had to hike up to this place. It took maybe 5 or 6 hours to hike up to a little cabin on top of a hill. And she would spend almost the entire summer there and report in a couple times a day if she saw any smoke or whatever. And of course, dealing with the animals and everything, she had to prepare her own food. And they would hike up and have a couple of donkeys, I think, that they would use to bring the coffee and food supplies up with her. And so she was the first woman, you know, that had ever done that job. So in a sense, she was a kind of trailblazer and a bit of a feminist, you know, for her time. Unfortunately, her first marriage didn't really work out, and she was Catholic, and you know, she was very devoted to the church. She played the organ every Sunday at the Sunday Mass and did a lot of volunteer work for the church. But when she ended up divorcing her first husband, and she got married not long after, because in the late 1950s, early 60s, there weren't many jobs available for women who had to feed, you know, three kids or so. And so she took on every bit of work she could, from mowing lawns to driving fence posts, you know, doing a man's job, basically a lot of hard labor type of work, doing laundry for people, cooking, anything to make a little bit extra money to you know, feed her kids. And then she got married again, mainly for us kids to have a bit of stability in our lives and a steady income. But once she got married again, that was basically prohibited in the Catholic Church back then. And so one Sunday shortly after she got married a second time, she went to church, you know, seeking some kind of solace, and the priest refused to give her communion. And in front of the whole congregation, there might have been 100 people there, and you know, a long line of people waiting to get the little wafer that the priest would give them. The priest bypassed her, just basically ignored her. And she reached out, grabbed the priest by the wrist, and demanded in front of the whole congregation that he explain why he wasn't giving her communion. And she ended up getting excommunicated from the church. But, you know, she had grown up a tomboy, and she had gotten into, you know, little fights as a teenager with other boys. She was very athletic. And, you know, I think just she had such strong family ties and such a strong family support system. And she was devoted entirely to her family that, you know, nothing would really stop her. And in her 40s, she started going to night school. I think she had saved some money working part-time at a florist shop, she took flight lessons, and she eventually got her private pilot's license. And actually, a couple of years later, in the Lake Tahoe area near Reno, Nevada, she was hired by the local airport, and she ended up actually working part-time for the Forestry Service, flying a small Cessna airplane and as a fire spotter, and would report, you know, where the smoke was coming from. And so her early experience as a fire spotter paid off there. Plus, she was the only woman doing that. And at that time, I think she actually became the head of the 99ers, which was a group of women's pilots, a national group. She was the head, not the national head, but the local head of the Reno chapter of the 99s. That was originally set up. I think their first president was Amelia Earhart, if I remember correctly.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you for a second, because as you were talking about her, I have a quote. I'm big on memes. I have a quote from Amelia Earhart that says something along the lines of, sometimes women need to do what men have done or something, and sometimes even things that men have not done, just primarily, I mean, as I say, I'm butchering it, but just to prove we can. So you were explaining that, I went, oh, that sounds like Amelia Earhart. And then, of course, you just talk about her now, so that's funny.
Yeah, she was competitive that way, and she loved to prove men wrong. And she had, later on in her 50s, actually, after she divorced the second time, the second marriage didn't really work out. I guess she was too much to handle. I don't know. But I always loved her dearly. She was like my best friend and a great listener to all our stories and empathetic with all the problems that teenagers go through. But at any rate, in her 50s, she went back to night school again to gain a qualification to become a legal secretary. And she became a legal secretary. And worked that job, probably, I think she was 78 when she finally retired. She got a nice little pension from that. And so she was just really independent. And she had a wonderful sense of humor. And she always got in the last word. And a good example of that is one time I had been bumming around the world. I was, I don't know, 25 or 26 or so, playing out a kind of Hemingway fantasy, you know, going to Paris to become an expat writer. And of course that didn't work out, but I ended up following the old hippie trail and with an Afghan and an Iranian, had quite a few adventures with them, but ended up in India. And when I came back to the States, I was completely out of money, sold my car to have a little bit of money to spend a couple months with my mother in the Lake Tahoe region. And she was still working at the airport and working for a judge part-time at that time. Anyway, her second husband was kind of complaining to her one night about my kind of hanging out at their place and mooching off of them. And he was complaining about, Bob's going to eat us out of house and home. And I was always eating his favorite snack. It's called Wheat Thins. And so my mother didn't say a word, but she got so angry that she went to the market, bought about 50 boxes of these Wheat Thins and stuck it in every possible corner, from where he was keeping his socks to his workshop to everywhere. You know, if he opened a drawer, there was a box of Wheat Thins for him. And she didn't talk to him for about a month at dinner. And finally, after about a month, he got the message and apologized to her. But that was her sense of humor and her way of getting in the last word. Yeah, she was a character, very determined, though, hard worker.
There's 100 women, right? I'm just thinking, oh, man, I would have liked to know her.
Oh, she was very gracious, very musical.
Yeah, she was also a bit of an athlete.
Yes, 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 she was. In her teenage years, you know, with, you know, how country kids will get together in an open field and just make up games to play, but she played a lot of softball at that time and did a lot of running. Of course, she was always climbing trees and, you know, working a lot of labor jobs just alongside the boys. So she was just as coordinated as they were. In her 20s, I think she ended up in a bowling league. She roller skated and she got a qualification to become a roller skating instructor. She did that for about 3 or 4 years when I was just a little boy. She used to go trekking a lot in the mountains. You know, if there was any kind of competition going on, she was right there, one of the first volunteers, and just very athletic. Yeah. Water skiing. She was a good water skier.
Oh, that's great. And especially in those days when, you know, women were supposed to be a little bit more delicate.
Yeah. Well, she was anything but that.
The other thing I read in the book was that she was worried about being forgotten.
Yeah, near the end of her life.
Yeah. Is that part of the reason for the book?
Yes, actually. You know, it came as kind of a shock, although she had gone through a lot of, in her 80s, she started going downhill a bit physically, but mentally she was always there. You know, I've lived in Japan now for over 40 years, and she ended up coming to Japan about 8 different times. And in her 60s, she began studying the Japanese language, and we would have these Skype calls where I would be her Japanese teacher. That was our main means of communication, and we had a lot of laughs over that. But at any rate, you know, as I mentioned before, she family was so important to her, and she had lost her only brother. He just kind of disappeared. I think he became an alcoholic and got into trouble and just almost disappeared off the face of the earth. And she didn't hear from him for 30 or 40 years until shortly before he died. He ended up calling her and accusing her of a lot of things. So I think the fact that she lost her brother, didn't have that close relationship. And yet on the other hand, she was so close with her mother and father and their respective families, her grandparents, that when it came to the end of her life, more than anything else, she, of course, like all of us, had a few regrets, I think, about things she had done or maybe hadn't done, had wanted to do. But from my point of view, I think she would have lived a really highly fulfilling and exciting life. And whatever she wanted to do, she gave it her best try. But she was so afraid of being forgotten. You know, family love was so important to her. And I think maybe dementia had started to set in a little bit, but in the week or two before she died, she was living with a sister in Portland, Oregon. And we were trying to stay in touch via Skype almost every day. But she started thinking about her life a lot and just, implored us, my sister and me, please don't forget me. Please don't forget me. I hope you won't forget me. And we always told her, Mom, nobody who's ever known you could ever forget you. You're such a powerful force and so full of love and joy and humor. And she just had such a large spirit. And so, yeah, it was kind of selfish, I suppose, on my part. But after she passed and I had all these audio recordings of stories that she told, where we'd sit down at the kitchen table, and I had a couple of videos. One time when she came to Japan, I had her become a guest speaker for one of my seminar classes up at the university where I was teaching, and we took a video of that. And she was a lifelong letter writer, a prolific writer. We had, a correspondence that dates back to the 1970s. And she had kept a lot of my letters, and I kept all of hers. And then I kept all the email letters that we'd sent back and forth for the last 25 years. So I had all this material, and I just wanted to preserve her spirit more than anything else. And also my own life has been fairly unique. So the easiest way to do that, I think, was to concentrate on our relationship and combine the two stories together. But yeah, it certainly played a huge role in my writing of the story. I wanted to introduce her to as many people as possible. What a unique individual she was and the influence that she had on my life. Yeah, so preserve those memories, preserve those stories.
It was interesting to me when I read that, because it was only a month or so ago that I had coffee with a former colleague, and I knew her dad, and he said, he's in his late 90s now, and he's ready to go, but she felt that he was afraid of being forgotten. And so I had said to her, take a notepad and ask him what he wants to be remembered for. And I'd actually worked with her mother, his wife, until she passed. And she was contemplating that idea. And then she said, do you remember how those bad jokes he used to tell? And I said, well, make sure you get a book of bad dad jokes, like that sort of thing. So his spirit, his legacy of bad dad jokes, will live on with his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren. So when I realized that was probably one of the main reasons you had written this book, I went, oh, good, I was on the money with that.
yeah, right on target, right on target.
Your book is called The Good Lord Willing and the Creek Don't Rise, Pentimento Memories of Mom and Me. Can you explain Pentimento Memories? I can barely say it. Pentimento Memories, please.
Yeah. I was a huge fan of the writer Lillian Hellman, who was Dashiell Hammett's lover for, God, 30, 40 years. But Dashiell Hammett was one of the creators of the sort of noir genre of detective stories. And he was quite a famous author in the 1920s, 1930s. But they were basically lovers from about the 1930s till the time he died, I think in the late 1950s. They never got married, but she was a playwright, very famous playwright in the 1930s. She wrote a play called The Children's Hour, which was probably her most famous one. It was about the sort of homosexual relationship between two teachers at a small, almost like a boarding school in a rural area, and they kept their relationship hidden, but it was discovered by the people, and it was a very dramatic story. It was turned into a film years and years later. But they both, in the 1930s and 1940s, like a lot of Hollywood people, ended up getting involved in not really communist activities, but exploring intellectual possibilities at a time of an alternate form of government, because at that time, capitalism and democracy weren't doing real well in the world in the 1930s. And a lot of Hollywood people were exploring other possibilities and having meetings. And then in the 1950s, during the communist witch hunt era of the House Un-American Activities Committee, headed up by Senator McCarthy, she was called in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, but she refused to cooperate. And yet her self-defense was voiced in such a way that they couldn't really legally attack her in any possible way. And so she was able to avoid prison, whereas Dashiell Hammett spent maybe 2 or 3 years, I think, in prison and was blacklisted from doing any further work in Hollywood at the time. And she later, in the 1960s, wrote a series of memoirs about her experiences in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and some of the people she was involved with. And the title of that first memoir was Pentimento. And pentimento is a term that's used in the world of art and painting. And what it means is that when a painter starts to sketch a scene in kind of a rough draft, and the scene might be, for example, an ocean scene, and then midway through, they change their mind and they, in a sense, repent, and they completely change the scene. It might be like a distant forest scene in the end, but originally it was totally different. And so she used that term as a metaphor for our memory, of how our memory changes as we age. And as we look back on our life, what we remember might be completely different from what originally happened or from what somebody else might have thought or experienced. And I thought, wow, that's incredible imagery. And so when I was going through all the materials that I had of mom's memories, all the audio tapes and the correspondence and pictures, and actually I remembered that my own memories of my mother changed a lot from what I had remembered, you know, prior to going through all the pictures and rereading all the old letters. It's like a whole new movie started in my mind about my life and my mother's life. And I thought, wow, that's an appropriate metaphor to use. And so I thought, my memories are pentimento memories. And the good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, that's something that mom, she was such an optimist. She used to call herself a cockeyed optimist. And she was always saw the positive in people and experiences, always looking for, you know, a silver lining around every cloud. And so whenever we kids were dealing with something we were having difficulty with, or whenever mom was sort of lamenting, you know, the cruelty of the fates, she would always hope for something, or she would try to console us by saying, oh, everything's going to be all right. You know, just keep working, keep hanging in there. And she would always sort of have an afterthought. It's like we'll often say, knock on wood or something like that. I think she picked it up from her grandmother on her mother's side. she would express that hope for the future, but always at the end she would say, "The good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise." And so I thought that expression really contained a lot of her own character and personality, and maybe naive optimism.
Yeah. Johnny Cash actually has a song.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But combining those two, you know, it seemed to fit for me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love the part, and we're going to get on to you in just a moment, but your mom's time as a young woman with her parents and grandparents, it seemed a simpler time, I guess. It wasn't easier, but it was simpler. And correct me if I'm wrong, but when you have nothing, almost everything is a treat, it's appreciated, and it becomes a memory unto itself.
Yes, yeah, I agree completely. Like I mentioned before, you know, even splitting the orange harvest, you know, her parents sort of instilled that value in her very strongly, I think, that nothing was to be taken for granted, and that you always have to think of other people first before you think of yourself. And if you have something, share it. And or if you have some good luck, pass it forward. And so I think her character was molded quite strongly by her parents and her grandparents and just the family unit. You know, the only way they could survive during the Depression was as a unit. None of them individually could have survived because basically food, you didn't know where your next meal was coming from during that time. And she didn't come from a highly educated family, but they loved education, they loved books, they loved stories, they loved history, and most of their stories had to do with family history. And so there was almost a kind of, I don't know, innate sense of the importance of family and how you have to survive as a unit. And if you don't have any money that you can spend on any gadgets to entertain you with, you know, you're left to your imagination. And so they were very creative and hardworking, and their sense of humor, you know, helped them survive. And they passed that down, I think, at least tried to. My memories of my grandparents as well on my mother's side were just nothing but bright and bubbly images of laughter. And of course, who knows, alcohol might have had a lot to do with it at the time too. But, you know, they liked their beer and their cocktails in the evening. But I don't know, they just always seemed happy. And there was always a really warm, inviting atmosphere. And I don't remember spending a lot of money to do things or go places. Everything was sort of self-contained. And yes, I think it was maybe a simpler time. And of course, for us baby boomers growing up in the 1960s and the world news being brought to you every night, you know, of how horrible things were, you know, outside of the area that you lived in, kind of darkened a lot of that bright optimism. So we probably grew up in a different time, you know, the Vietnam War and women's liberation and Black Revolution and women's rights. And Mom and her family were very much aware of what was going on in the outside world. And I think she was very modern that way. But when it came to family, things were simple. And there's that warm meal every night. And you know, we had to eat our vegetables, you know, had to clean up our plates. If we didn't eat the greens, we couldn't excuse ourselves from the table. So they were somewhat strict. They taught us independence. You know, we were given a very small, what would you call it? Not a wage, but what's the English word I'm looking for? If you do chores around the house.
Allowance.
Oh, yeah, like an allowance. And we had to work really hard to get, you know, just 50 cents or something. We had to do a lot of heavy labor type work, you know, maintaining the house and the lawn. And we lived right next to the woods, so there was a lot of briars clearing, and we had our own garden. We had to pick our vegetables, and, you know, there was a lot of work to be done, but, you know, they instilled those values in it. And I don't know. I haven't been back in the States, for 40 years, other than brief visits, now and then. So I'm kind of like Rip Van Winkle, stuck in a time warp. I really don't know how kids are being raised these days, but if you believe everything that you see on the news and in a lot of films, it's a lot more complicated these days, I think.
Yeah, it truly is. Now, you mentioned the Vietnam War. I grew up in a tiny town. We did not have television, and I can remember coming out to the city for, I don't know, maybe Christmas holidays or something when I was about 10 or 11, probably. Maybe, yeah, 10 or 11. And seeing TV for the first time, but the first scenes I saw on a television were of dead bodies in Vietnam as the news
Oh,
coverage rolled
yeah.
through. And I mean, I just remember being, as a child, just glued to it, but also horrified. Now,
Yeah,
let's move
yeah.
on to you because this is the perfect segue. You finished high school in the late 60s. The US involvement in the Vietnam War was already in full swing. You went off and joined the Air Force. Why,
That's right.
given the, like, I'll do a little bit of foreshadowing here. You were and are a conscientious objector. Why the Air
That's right.
Force?
That's right. Yeah, I've often been asked that through the years, and basically, yeah, if you go back to the 1960s, we were faced with the draft, conscription, and if you didn't register for the draft, you could be thrown away into prison for up to 5 years, and be sort of have a scarlet letter, on your forehead, marked for life. And of course, my father was a World War II hero, and we grew up in the 1950s, filled with the occasional movie that glorified the soldiers of that time. I remember reading comic books that portrayed the Japanese soldiers and the German soldiers as almost caricatures of crazy manga monsters, and the American heroes were always the supermen and the John Wayne movies that came out and westerns. Sort of we were inculcated into a kind of strange militaristic patriotism, I think. And a lot of kids at that time wanted to be like their fathers and become war heroes in the same way. And so in the early 1960s, of course, not just the Vietnam War, but there were all these other problems that were actually being televised on the daily or evening news, like the civil rights riots. And so we were kind of country bumpkins hidden away behind the redwood curtain, but still we watched the news every night and thought, wow, in the outside world, there's a lot of violence and a lot of trouble going on out there. And then probably around 1964, 65, you started to hear about the demonstrations that were going on nationwide on college campuses and anti-war groups. And here and there would be the occasional soldier that came back and would be, speaking against the war based on his own experiences. And I remember about 1965, 66, there was a folk song called The Eve of Destruction, and with powerful anti-war lyrics. And then Bob Dylan was coming on the scene. And so we were very much aware that there was an anti-war movement growing in the country. And I graduated from high school in 1969. So we went through 1968 with the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, and then the horrible Democratic Convention riots and brutality of the Chicago police on the demonstrators, and all that was brought into our homes. And so we were very much aware of what was going on. And there was the fear of, well, if I get drafted, I'll be sent immediately to the front lines, and the possibility of being killed by someone in a country I'd never heard of before. What are they fighting for? I never clearly understood, I mean, our fathers would say they're fighting for democracy, but what does that really mean? What does that entail? And so, I was a naive country bumpkin, and I thought, well, what are my choices here? I knew I'd probably get drafted after I graduated from high school at the age of 18. And your options were you could either go to Canada and probably never be able to return to the States again, and or would you even be accepted in Canada? Where could you find a job? Or would you have to go underground there? What kind of life? I didn't know anybody who had done that, so that seemed out of the question. The other alternative was just wait and get drafted and probably be sent to the war. And then a third option was either joining the Navy or the Air Force, which if you were drafted into the Army or the Marines, it was a 2-year commitment and a minimum of probably a year of being sent to the front lines of Vietnam. And at that time, 68, 69, you know, they were drafting more and more people. There were more and more people getting killed. And you might remember the body bags and the daily counts. It was almost like a football score. We killed 337 Viet Cong, but they only killed 22, you know, American soldiers. So we were winning the game. That was sort of the mentality. And I was starting to hear the voices of a few soldiers who had returned, and, you know, they're having problems adjusting to society and they hated the war. So I went to visit an Air Force recruiter, and he painted this image. He said, "No problem, boy. You can play basketball all day long. You'll have all the girlfriends you can possibly imagine. You can visit all these great countries, nothing but a big adventure. You'll never have to go to war. Don't you worry about it." And I said, "Where do I sign?" So I love basketball. So I thought, well, that's one way to go. And so within the first 20 minutes of military boot camp, I realized I'd made a mistake, and this was not the life for me. And as it turned out, you know, I'd been promised that I'd never have to carry a weapon, never have to worry about being trained for war or anything. Well, as it turned out, I got put in the only career field in the Air Force that was combat trained and had to learn how to use all these weapons. And eventually my job became guarding B-52 bombers. I was first sent to a base in Northern California, and night after night after night of walking around these immense B-52 bombers that looked like, I don't know, some kind of prehistoric bird of prey, you know, just the horrible things and all the destruction that was going on. And at that time, there was a growing movement from within the military against the war. And I got involved with a couple of guys who were putting out an underground anti-war GI newspaper. And I was listening more and more to the anti-war lyrics of groups like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Bob Dylan, and a lot of these groups. And in the evenings, sitting around and talking with soldiers who had come back from the war, and they were talking about the My Lai massacre and you know, a lot of the things that were going on. So it was like an incredible education for me. And I knew that my feelings were against the war, but to apply for conscientious objector status, I thought that you had to have a strong religious background, which I didn't have. You know, I didn't come from a historic peace church background or anything like that. But in early part of 1970, a precedent-setting Supreme Court decision was made that allowed for not just religious reasons for applying for conscientious objector status, but you could also apply under moral and philosophical grounds if you could prove the sincerity of your beliefs. And so that became a possibility. But for me, really, the final straw was the Kent State shootings. Were four university kids at Kent State in Ohio were shot and killed. And I think about 10 others were wounded by the National Guard, which had been brought in to put down these anti-war riots that were going on, demonstrations. And this was all as a result of Nixon, the president at the time, had been promising the country for about a year that he was winding down the war and that we were going to get out of Vietnam and that the soldiers were going to be brought home. Because the national mood at that time was shifting very strongly against the war, even amongst the older generation. And then secretly, and didn't even go to Congress to get a declaration of war, but secretly expanded the war into Cambodia and Laos, And that's what created all the problems in the end of April, beginning of May in 1970, was the country's reaction to his coming on the national news maybe 2 or 3 days after the original invasion of those countries. And man, there were mass riots everywhere, maybe 400 different universities. They were actually burning down these reserve officer training buildings on campuses. And you know, it was a bad situation. And I realized then that if I was ever called upon, like the National Guard, and we had to undergo that type of training, you know, to try and put down a demonstration, because a lot of military bases had to deal with the same thing. A lot of young people were demonstrating almost violently outside the bases. I would throw down my weapon and join the other side and start putting flowers into the bayonets of the soldiers. But I knew then that was the last straw. And shortly after, my order came to go to Vietnam. And so I spent about a month thinking very seriously about it. I was supposed to report to a base in Texas for further war training. But again, I was faced with that choice of either going to Canada, going underground, or following the order. And then there was the other option of filing for conscientious objector status, which I did. And of course, that was refused. And they were in a big rush to make an example of me to the other soldiers. And so I was court-martialed. And the military crime that I was charged with was what they called willful disobedience to a direct lawful order. And after a day of deliberation in the courtroom, I was found not guilty of the original charge, but guilty of a lesser charge, which they called negligent disobedience to a direct lawful order. And the difference between willful and negligent was in how I had responded to the original order when it was given to me in front of witnesses by my commanding officer. And I never used the word no. I just kept repeating one sentence: I don't feel I'm mentally or physically capable of killing another human being. And that single sentence saved 4.5 years of my life, basically. It was a powerful introduction to the power of language. And that sort of set or ignited the fire in me of, I don't know, a strong interest in language, and my mother's storytelling came back. And as an aside, just to give another example of my mother's character, shortly after I had been court-martialed and thrown in the brig, my mother somehow stormed onto the military base where I was being held and demanded to see my commanding officer. And she went into his office and they got into a heated argument, and she was demanding to see me and he wouldn't allow her. And she was physically escorted off the base by the security police and told, you know, with their M16 guns pointed at her, she would never be allowed back on base. And if she did, she would be thrown in the brig herself. But just to show her guts and her love for her family, you know.
Oh, that's great. And, so you served 6 months then?
Yes, yes. Yeah, the first couple of months were on the local base in a very small jail. And then later on, they sent me to what was, I think, unique to the Air Force. It was called a retraining group at a base in Denver, Colorado. But the retraining meant that if you were guilty of a nonviolent crime, rather than kicking you out of the service, the Air Force felt that it would be a waste of the money they had spent in training you, and that if they gave you the opportunity to train into a different career field, you could serve out your so-called bad time and then come back to the Air Force and complete your four-year obligation in a different career field. But by then, I was so, you know, far gone that I didn't want to play their game. To me, the retraining was really just a form of brainwashing. We had to go through all these educational programs designed to inculcate you into anti-communism, and you know, they would show these propaganda type films of young people who got kicked out of the service with a bad discharge and returned to society, and they were never able to make it back in society, and they ended up committing suicide or something like that. And, you know, that, to a lot of us young hippie soldiers at that time, it was kind of hilarious. I was kicked out of the service with what they called an undesirable discharge, which, you know, there at the time there were five different types of discharges. Your honorable discharge, where you get certain benefits like the GI Bill that helps pay for college education or housing loans, those kinds of things. Then if you're unable to adapt to military life for one reason or another, you would be given an administrative discharge, which was called a general discharge. You would lose certain benefits, but it wasn't like a black mark on your, or a stain on your record. Then there's the undesirable discharge. I kind of embraced that title myself. and that was also an administrative discharge. Then bad conduct discharge, which, you know, was a pretty heavy black mark to carry. And then the dishonorable discharge, which was reserved for traitors and murderers and people of that ilk. And so I went back to society with this undesirable discharge. And I have to admit that, you know, their retraining program did put some questions into my head, and I lost a lot of confidence. I was only 19 at the time, and so I really wasn't articulate enough to explain my feelings to convince a lot of people. And whenever you applied for a job, you had to fill out an application form, and the application form, no matter what job that you were applying for, had at the end of the form a little section of have you had any military service and what kind of discharge did you have? And then that inevitably would start a political argument with my potential employer. And actually, it served in my favor on a few cases for low-level labor jobs, you know, working in a sawmill or something like that. But in many cases, the person who interviewed me was old enough to be like a World War II veteran, and we would get into these really big arguments about the war. But they seemed to like my spunk, and I got hired in a couple of cases because of that. I don't agree with you politically, but you've got spunk, you know, so we're going to give you a chance, your last chance.
So you did get a couple of jobs in the U.S., but then you started, I think you started in Europe. You went east from there, finally ending up in Japan. What was the time frame from the, I mean, because I think you came back a few times, but from the time you decided you needed to get out of the U.S. at 19 or 20, whenever it was, until the time you landed in Japan, how long was that?
Pretty long time, actually. I call my 20s my nomad days, you know, spelled D-A-Z-E. Once I got out of the service, I completely embraced the counterculture and all that went along with it. And so unlike the former president, Bill Clinton, I did inhale at the time.
Amongst other things.
At any rate, the consciousness expanding.
That's all right.
At any rate. Yeah, I worked in the sawmills for a while. I tried going back to school and playing basketball for 1 year, but that didn't work out. I was a couple, 3 years older than these very naive kids of 18, fresh out of school. And, you know, our worlds were, you know, totally poles apart. And I just felt somewhat like a fish out of water. One day maybe a couple of years later, by 1973, I came across a book called Europe on $5 a Day, and explained how you could hitchhike and bum around Europe and on a backpack and camping out. And I thought, hey, this is for me. So I embarked upon what I now think of as a kind of search for identity. And I hitchhiked across the United States, bummed around Europe for maybe 5 or 6 months or so, and I was in constant contact with a lot of these young European hippies of the time, and they seemed to have, I don't know, really fulfilled, exciting lives, expressing themselves. There were a lot of poets and musicians and painters, and they would listen to my story and accept my story and encourage me. And it was a real boost to my confidence. And at the same time, I felt a bit embarrassed and envious because they could all speak three or four different languages, and I could only speak my native English, and barely at that. You know? And so they pointed me in the direction of setting out a kind of itinerary for me to visit these famous art museums around different parts of Europe, Louvre Museum and the Prado Museum and all these great works of art. And so Europe and the young hippies that I met on the road and the art and art history really influenced me a lot. And when I came back to the States, I felt like I had a direction. I wanted to express myself too in some way, and I wanted to become a writer. And so I started studying journalism, and while working different labor type jobs, you know, I was reading a lot of literature, and then I started writing like a sprinter, starting out with 100-meter dash and working up to maybe a marathon, you know, by writing very short stories and then longer stories. And about 4 years later, I was ready to write a novel because I'd had so many unusual experiences by that time. And so, I was under the influence of writers like Henry Miller, who was an expatriate writer in the 1930s, and Hemingway, of course. And I thought, geez, I'd like to go back to Paris and live there and live out this dream for a while. So this was 1977. I returned to Paris. I'd saved a few thousand dollars and began writing a novel. And that's when fate kind of intervened. And one day when I came back to my very cheap motel room on the left bank, there was an Iranian and an Afghan trying to convey a message to the desk clerk, who spoke only French, of course. And so by then I picked up a little bit of French. And so I was able to give a crude translation to the desk clerk, who understood. And these two men were overjoyed. And we went out to have some tea, and they invited me back to their countries, and my money was disappearing quickly. So I thought, I've never been, you know, to any Muslim countries before. It might be an interesting adventure. And they convinced me that I could find a job. This was when the Shah was still in power. It was before the Islamic Revolution. So there were still quite a few American oil companies dominating that part of the world. And so I returned with them. We went on the old hippie trail, and this Iranian bought a car in Germany and planned to sell it in Iran to cover the cost of the journey. You know, Iran's economy was booming at the time. And so I never did find a job, but I ended up having some interesting adventures for a couple of months, you know, in the eastern mountains of Turkey and into Iran. And then finally, when my visa ran out, I went into Afghanistan and spent about a month there with my Afghan friend. And that was quite an education. You know, very few people have a chance to go there. I haven't been able to go there since around 1979. And eventually in India, where I got very sick and I was almost out of money, and I was sleeping on the streets with the lepers and the untouchables and all the questions of, is there a God? And if there is a God, you know, well, why does he allow this kind of suffering? And so by the time I spent the last of my money for a return ticket, I arrived in Los Angeles with about 25 cents to my name and a severe case of reverse culture shock. And that's when I ended up going to my mother's place and spending time with her and my stepfather, and the Wheat Thins incident happened. So, but after that, I picked up the skill of cooking. And so I became a cook for about the next 4 or 5 years. And I would work for about 6 months, save a little bit of money, you know, living in some, you know, flea bag hotel room, or, you know, and writing stories, studying more. And ended up in the South working on the oil rigs for a while. And so all throughout the last part of my 20s, that was my life, was working, saving some money, writing as much as possible, staying high a lot, drinking way too much, but experiencing a lot of different things. But at that time, I had this dream that because that initial introduction to the power of language, I never lost it. It stayed with me. And I always had this dream of living and working and studying in a foreign country. And I thought maybe Spain or Greece, someplace like that. But as fate would have it, a writer friend of mine who was living on the island of Maui invited me to come stay at his place, and I could have a room for free and write as much as I wanted to. And I'd been working in a camp, save a few thousand dollars, and that sounded like a great deal. So I ended up going to Maui, but I didn't write more than maybe a couple of letters to my mother, and that was about the extent of it, and was partying most of the time. But he had had a couple of his books translated into Japanese, and his books were more successful in Japan than they had been in the United States. And so he thought, well, you might think about going to Japan. Japan's economy was booming at the time. This was around 1982, 1983. He had the address of a friend, and he introduced me to the friend, and the friend agreed to put me up for as long as it took until I got set up a bit. And so I bought a one-way ticket to Japan, and I've been here for 41 years since then. And I just followed my instinct, and it turned out to be the best decision I ever made. But that time period, to get back to your original question, that was maybe from the age of 18, I arrived in Japan at the age of 32, so about 13, 14 years. Just bumming around like that, but a lot of stuff to write about afterwards.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. It's funny, in my notes, I had done the fast forward to Japan, and what I quoted one of my favorite singers, Carmen McRae, and that seems to be where you made up your mind to straighten up and fly right. So something happened in Japan where you just said, time for me to get my act together, or something like that.
Yeah, I met my wife.
Okay, yay, the power of another woman.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that she really set me straight. It was just that I was intrigued. This interest in language, as I said, never left me. And all of a sudden, this dream came true. And I got a job initially working as an English teacher in a conversation school. And I liked the work, and so I started studying a lot about how to become a good teacher. And then just the fact of to survive in a foreign country, you have to learn the language. And so most of my time away from work was spent in studying Japanese. And then, of course, trying to use the language, you can't just study it passively. You have to turn it from passive knowledge into active knowledge. You have to go out and create chances to use the language. And so I ended up being invited to play on a softball team in the local city league with some of my neighbors. And sports were really the means of communicating with the local people. And it was interesting because softball, baseball, I'm a big baseball fan, and the Japanese love baseball as well. And there's enough English words with Japanese pronunciation, of course, like a strike ball becomes striku, boru, auto, and all these words, I could pick up on, and I could talk about baseball. And so everything that I was learning about Japanese, different patterns, different vocabulary, different verb conjugations, this kind of thing, I could use to talk about baseball. And there was enough repetition, and everybody wanted to talk about baseball. So I soon was able to converse on that topic. And then once you learn a few patterns, you just change the verbs or the nouns, and you can switch from sports to you talk about your job or your family. And they were filled with questions about why did you come to Japan? What was life like? And so I was constantly engaged with study and using what I was studying, and it was all very fascinating to me, making friends, and there was no time to really spend in other pursuits, you know. And involved in all this excitement, I met my wife, and her English was great. She was an interpreter, and eventually became what they call a simultaneous interpreter, which is a really difficult field because, you know, what you hear, you have to convey the message immediately. You can't take notes on it so much. And for two languages as different in Japanese and English, that's a real difficult task because the word order in English and Japanese are reversed. And in Japanese, the verb comes at the end of the sentence. And so for the Japanese, when they're expressing something, they're kind of at the same time reading what their listener's response is. And if it looks like it's not going well, they can switch the verb from a positive to a negative at the end of the sentence. Whereas, you know, in English, we commit ourselves to our opinion right off the bat, you know, with the subject verb. And quite often the subject is omitted in Japanese because it's understood, you know, among native speakers through context. And so all this, you know, cultural differences, it was all really fascinating for me. But eventually, after I got married, I committed to the life of an expatriate, permanent expatriate. I realized that a conversation school teacher was not a very stable or steady job. And so the best possible job that I could hope for would be working as a full-time foreign teacher at a Japanese university. But in order to do that, you had to have a minimum of a master's degree. So in addition to my Japanese studies and studying about how to teach English as a foreign or second language, I found a correspondence course. This is way before the internet, of course. And so it was a real correspondence course where you had to get your assignments and then write out the paper and stick them in an envelope with a stamp on it and send it. And it took me 7 years, but just through, again, my mother's determination, perseverance, the never give up type of attitude that kept me going. And she encouraged me the whole time as well through all the correspondence that we had and her visiting Japan every once in a while. One of my part-time jobs when I finally got the master's degree was teaching at a women's junior college. And just as I got the master's degree, a full-time position opened up for a foreign teacher. And so I was among what maybe about 50 people who applied for the job, and it boiled down to this other person and myself. And my competitor, of course, had a much better resume than I had. And yet, when it came down to the end interview, which was in Japanese, she panicked and wasn't able to speak Japanese very well. But, you know, I had picked up enough Japanese by that time where I could convince them that I could perform the job without any special needs or for other interpreters or special care or treatment. I could go out to the high schools along with the other teachers to try to recruit students to come to the university, or I could participate in meetings. And as it turned out, I ended up becoming a professor a few years later and had to be like the dean of students for a couple of years, which involved a lot of public speaking and meeting with parents and the police and a lot of different people, and had to conduct meetings. I was a member of maybe six or seven different committees in that position as the dean, and I had to lead the meetings. And so, you know, when there's a difference of opinion, you know, how do you summarize what's been discussed and then move on to the next item of discussion and all those. And, you know, Japanese is really complicated in terms of the different levels of politeness and showing respect to other people. So it was a lot of homework that I had to do. And so I've been constantly occupied, you know, through all these years, but it's been fascinating the whole time.
I'm sure it helped to sort of jumping into the community, like with baseball and all the other things, as opposed to hiding away with an expat community,
where
you could go home and at least speak English at the end of the day. You know, you were really immersed in, Unfortunately, I'm looking at the clock. Is there any story, any life lesson that you'd like listeners to think about after all of those adventures? And
I would have to say the lessons that my mom taught me, is that everything will work out, the good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. But as long as you put in the efforts and always treat other people with respect, become a better listener, so you can be more empathetic with others and their own struggles. But always work hard. Always be considerate, because you never know who's looking, who's watching. And if you try to cut corners, it's going to be noticed. And that's one of the reasons that I was able to survive and actually prosper in Japan, is because I was so determined. And I think this became a part of my character that I picked up unconsciously from my mom, was that always work harder than other people and you will eventually survive. Make yourself indispensable, even if it's as a dishwasher in the beginning, because that's the way I got most of my jobs in my 20s, was at the lower rung of the ladder. And then I would work so hard and that would be noticed by somebody. And within a month, I would be elevated to a line cook or something. And the same thing has happened here in Japan. The reason I became the dean of students was because I went to work maybe a half an hour earlier than other teachers did. Like a first period class, I would go into the class maybe, into the classroom 10 minutes before the class was scheduled to start. And so any students who wanted to come in and practice their English would have a chance for a one-on-one conversation with me. And the president of the university's wife, who used to come up to the school early and would take care of like the flower beds on the road leading up to the campus itself. And I was always the first one, to arrive after she was there. And we would always have a morning greeting. And later on, he was elevated from a professor in one of the departments to become the president of the university. And he had to come up with a list of candidates for these top positions, his cabinet, so to speak, the dean of students, the head of different committees. He thought that I would be ideal for the students because he knew that I cared about the students. And so that was the reason that I was elevated into that position. And I was always trying to improve myself. And I think if you just work hard and don't take any shortcuts, somebody will notice. And always be positive. Always consider the other person before yourself. I kind of believe in karma a bit. All throughout my 20s and late teens, all the sort of difficult times that I had, I think we're all connected to bad karma because I was so selfish and thinking of myself all the time, But once I finally made it to Japan, and as a means of survival, when you're traveling and you don't speak another language, you learn to observe and sort of mimic the way other people conduct their lives. And so I became a much better listener, and I started thinking of other people before thinking of myself. And I think there's a connection there that my luck really changed when I switched that attitude. And so I would encourage other people to think of others before yourself and work hard. Somebody will notice, the good Lord willing, and the truth.
There you go. Either you or me, or you, me and your mother were cut from the same cloth. Okay, so the good Lord willing and the creek don't rise. Where do we find your book?
Oh, it's at Amazon and any other online bookseller, but you can find me at robertwnorris.com. And I have links to all the possible places, whether ebook or in print. And if people are kind of against the behemoth megalithic corporate structure called Amazon, then you know they can go to bookshop.org or they can order the book at their local independent bookstore. You know, it's all there on my homepage.
Okay. Before I close, I always ask a personal question, but I did hint at the beginning that you and I have something else in common. And you were involved with exchanges. So I'm going to tell you my story, and then I'm going to let you sort of follow up with a story. I was really freaked out when this happened to me, but it never fails to get a laugh now. So that's sort of where you're going to go with your story if you've got one. So it's the early 2000s. I'd been separated for several years, three teenagers at home, and I get talked into speed dating. So it was like, what am I doing? Like, but, you know, like you go with your friends, right? So I went speed dating with my friends. And sure enough, it's this big room in a real nice hotel downtown Victoria. And there's approximately 40 to 50 tables set up. And the routine for this particular evening is the men will stay at the tables. And we women get, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes, whatever it is, to talk to a man. And then you do a yay or nay on your card. So I'm just going like, what am I doing? This is not me in the least. And so I'm doing my thing and I'm just trying to figure out what's the earliest I can get out of here with my friends. And they take an intermission. So I go to the bar, I get a glass of wine and I come back and I'm just sort of standing there looking over and trying to figure out where my next table is going to be. And I realize there's already a woman there. So I guess basically what had happened is that the next man I was supposed to talk to would be a really good looking man. So this other woman had said, I'm going to get there first. And I realized it had gone a little chaotic in the intermission. So I just stayed up on this walkway and I decided to watch. So they get back and they're doing their speed dating. And I suddenly feel a presence beside me. And I turn and look and it's a Japanese man. And he says, like, what are they doing? And I said, well, it's called speed dating. I gave him the explanation and he was so excited. He said, oh my goodness, if speed dating came to Japan, I would do it in a second. And so I looked at him and I said, oh, well, you're single then. And he goes, oh, no, I'm married. I've been married for 30 years. So trying to get away from this whole subject, because now I'm a little uncomfortable. I said, like, what does it take to stay married for 30 years? And lovely man. He looks at me and he says, every morning when my wife wakes up, I tell her how lucky she is to be married to me. He said, and then I go out and earn more money than she can spend. And so we chatted for a while. We watched this for a while. And then he was gone to his room and it was finally done. And my friends and I left. So as I mentioned, three teenagers at home, I was doing some exchange homestays. I'd had a lovely young man from France for a week, and then I was due to pick up a Japanese student. And so on the Sunday morning, I go back down coincidentally to the same hotel and trying to figure out how to pick up, you know, like I don't know what the routine is with this Japanese school. And the Canadian person gets up and she's talking and then she introduces, I don't know, the executive director or whatever it is of the school in Japan. And who goes up to the podium but the man that I had been talking with on Friday night. So my only thought, I mean, I was dressed nicely. I was dressed smartly. You know, I wasn't out looking for dates, but I was mortified. I just thought, oh my God, he is going to realize that he is entrusting one of his precious students to a woman who speed dates. I was like literally mortified. He spots me. He comes over. He is as friendly. He thinks I was fabulous. And it's like, okay, apparently I got away with this. Went home with my student. She stayed for a week. A couple of weeks later, I wasn't on the roster, so I was not going to be part of this group. So they arrive on the Sunday. Monday afternoon, I get a phone call at work saying, Agnes, we've had a situation with two girls in a Victoria home, and we need a new placement for them right this minute. Can you take them? And I said, well, let me finish up my work. I'll go home. I'll change beds. I'll get everything organized. And sure, just come on over at like 5 or whatever. So she said, I'm so glad you could do this. She said, when the executive director knew that we had this issue, he said, you have to phone Agnes and see if she'll take them. So apparently my whole situation with speed dating was a plus to this Japanese. Anyways, it was one of those where I was mortified at the time, but I laugh now. Do you have a story that was like, oh my God, at the time, and you're laughing now?
As a chaperone, you know, for a lot of these students, I must have chaperoned maybe 8 groups through the years, you know, to different places. One time to Australia, another time to the UK, once to Vancouver Island, the University of Victoria.
I knew you looked familiar.
Yeah, I was probably that one in the corner trying to, you know, hide myself. But it was, to be a chaperone takes a lot out of you. Yeah, I mean, for one thing, you're worried about every kid, every moment of the day. And a lot of these Japanese kids grow up on American movies, and they have like these idealized visions of how they're going to be. Cinderella and Prince Charming is going to come and sweep them away, and they all want to have just the greatest experience. And we tried, at least when I was still working, to provide them with enough orientation information and activities to help them. But most of the time, it had no effect on them at all. And so a lot of these kids, especially in the 1990s, they were a bit on the spoiled side. And so it was not that unusual to have a kid complain about their homestay family, because in the beginning, the first 2 or 3 days, because the image that they had of going there, being treated like royalty, and then the reality of, you know, some working family that was in some cases actually getting a little bit of extra money by renting out their room to the school for these students, and that they had their own work lives to deal with, and their kids were independent, and the kids were just shown the kitchen, say, okay, you cook your own breakfast in the morning, and you know, and here's how you use the transportation, you know, the bus service to get there. And so there was a cultural clash there in the beginning. So I usually have to meet with the students and explain once again the reality of the situation, that in the West, being independent is a key, you know, cultural important thing to be able to have, you know, as part of your survival skills. And, you know, many times the kids, if they made it through the first 2 or 3 days, and another shock that they would have was that even though they might do well in Japan on some of their English tests, or you know, they'd get good grades in their English classes, when it came to the reality of dealing with the way language is used in the street and at home, dialects and a lot of nuances, slang and different vocabulary, fast, rapid speech, reduced forms, they couldn't understand a thing. And so I would have to be a bit of a babysitter for them for the first 3 or 4 days. And I do remember that this one group that I took to a suburb of London, they had hired as their teacher a college student to come in and teach during the summer months. And of course, this student had no clue of what they would be dealing with these Japanese students. And there was just a complete shutdown of the classroom for the first 2 or 3 days. The kids didn't understand what they were supposed to do. The teacher got frustrated, was yelling at the kids. The kids were thinking that she was a racist teacher. And so everything came to my shoulders. And I actually had to come in for 3 or 4 days in a row, attend the classes that they were taking, and interpret everything that the teacher said, and for the students to be able to, you know, get used to the new environment. And after 3 or 4 days, the routine was such that it was almost the same every day. And they got accustomed to the new environment. But those first 3 or 4 days, I went to the pub every night and had at least 4 or 5 beers, you know, each time. But we survived. We survived.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Pub every night, 4 or 5 beers. That's a really good way to wrap. Okay. So your website link is in the show notes.
Thank you.
And all the links are on your page at our website. Listeners, Bob has had such a myriad of experiences. Small town life in the 50s. Large, extended, hardworking family, conscientious objector, travels, drugs, and then a settled life in a different country, learning a new language, and excelling where no Westerner ever had, all the while acknowledging the people who were unquestioningly loyal throughout all of his ups and downs. Do you have any parallel stories? I'd like to hear them. Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. Maybe there was something Bob and I didn't dig deep enough into. Mention it in the comments and I'll get you an answer, or I'll resend the link to buy the book. Take 2 minutes now, jump over to Apple Podcasts, leave stars and a review. They help us keep the algorithm gods happy. And share this episode. I started Bob's book with an eye to gleaning enough details to having an intelligent conversation with him. I couldn't put it down. If you share our conversation today with your book club, I will be very surprised if The Good Lord Willin' and The Creek Don't Rise doesn't become a must-read. Before we close, the Boomer Woman's podcast is becoming a fixture. You can buy me a coffee. That's a pretty cheap option considering my taste in coffee. Or you can subscribe to Buy Me a Coffee each month that does gain you some Age Pacific's perks. That link is in the show notes and above Bob's head on his page at our website. And there's also Substack now. Following there is free. Robert Norris, Bob, thank you for being my guest today, sharing some of your amazing mum with us women who also want to be remembered, and for being so candid about the good bits and the crap bits of your life.
Well, thank you very much, Agnes. This has been fun. I really enjoyed it. Let's stay in touch.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'd love to hear more. You have a great rest of week.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.